You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Oh, it is?
It is.
What?
And listen, I know it is week two of March, but it is week one of our Women's History Month.
Yeah, get on behind. Our schedule.
I know.
Get on our schedule.
We're a mess.
We're no, we mess. Are not a mess. Black History Month is a goddamn fucking mess.
Yeah, but we were a week behind on that.
No, we were. No, we were. Let's just forget all about that.
It's fine. We're here now.
We are here now. Now I'm here.
Yes. All right. And we've had a glass of champagne each, so we're feeling pretty good.
But and a half a cup of coffee each.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're riding pretty high at the moment.
I'm also, like, I feel like I've had so many, like, stimulants, but my brain is still really tired. And so it's a really weird dichotomy going on within myself right
now. I'm really hoping my energy maintains through the end of this episode and then I just crash. Like, I just want to crash hard.
Yep.
And sleep through the night. Like,
that's, I already warned y'all if the mini episode is up a little later. Didn't get up in the morning.
Yeah, that's all I can hope for. But we were trying to decide what we wanted to do for Women's History Month this month or this year. And I feel like we still don't have like a clear, cohesive vision of what the month is going
to
look like.
Which we don't really have to. I know that last year we covered everything that was first wave. So I was like, well, then we would do second wave this year. But we've covered so much of the second wave.
I don't want to repeat ourselves too much.
And we'd have to get really deep and there would be a lot of repetition because we've covered so many of like the major events during that time. So I think we are just kind of do like a general...
Yeah, like
women's history.
What's up?
Yeah, what's up, women?
Hi.
Hi. So this was actually a really fun one for me, but also a super complicated one for me.
So much more complicated than I anticipated. So I had suggested this to you. I was like, I was absolutely enamored with Egyptian, ancient Egyptian history and culture whenever I was a kid. I had all the books. I had a pop-up book about mummification, which looking back now is pretty morbid.
But like that, I feel like that's a thing that kids get into. Like I feel like every kid has their tragedy that they kind of latch onto. Like for me, one of the big ones was Titanic.
Oh, yeah.
Another big one was the Holocaust.
Oh,
I was like very interested in those tragedies for some reason in particular as a child, where I feel like there is like a certain... story of things that are really twisted that happened a long time ago that kind of resonates with each of us in a weird way.
Yeah.
And I think that for a lot of people, mummies, ancient Egypt, and all of that is like a just big obsession.
It was a few things, I think. There was this mystical quality about all of that stuff. You know, the gods fascinated me. Egyptian gods fascinated me so much more than Greek gods. Not that Greek mythology wasn't interesting to me. It was. But there was something about this in particular Then there was the media. We had the 90s The Mummy movie, which was huge for me growing up. And then Prince of Egypt.
I was just going to say Prince of Egypt was
huge.
Huge to me. And I was going to mention this too. I think that there's a lot of people that are religious that have a lot of fascination with ancient Egypt because there is so much tied to ancient Egypt with like Jewish people, with Catholic. I mean, there's so much tied in religious history in ancient Egypt where I feel like we learn some of that stuff and things of that era, which kind of like draws toward that. And then Prince of Egypt was a big one.
Oh, huge.
Because it kind of shows you why worshiping the gods were bad and why worshiping the one true God was the most powerful. But then I had slapped songs.
That soundtrack hit so hard.
I can still watch the movie without getting pissed off because I love the music
so
much.
I set my religious trauma to the side
when
Prince of Egypt is on.
That goes to sleep for 2 hours so I can watch this masterpiece.
It is so good. And yeah, I mean, ask me which books of the Bible I have read like from one end to the other, and Exodus is in there. And that's Old Testament, which is dry as hell. Yeah. Usually, but
Exodus is bad as hell. Like, that's where all the shit goes down.
Yeah,
and that's why
Egypt,
it's fascinating.
You're in Egypt, shit is happening, plagues are happening.
I was gonna say, that's like when all the plagues and shit happen.
It's the Prince of Egypt book of the Bible, and it is amazing. I mean, I'm not advocating for you going to read your Bible, but like,
okay, this was funny though. I was listening to another podcast where one of the hosts was like, I love the Bible. There's so many good stories in there. I don't think any of them are real, but they're really good stories.
I agree. There are fun stories in the Bible. There are also horrific stories
but
in the Bible.
But that makes them interesting, too. Mm. It's filled with great stories. If you
So with all of that said, we
encourage you to rage on.
We're not there yet.
No.
But with all of that said, we were talking about like what we would do this month, and I've always had a massive interest because of my interest in ancient Egypt. I always had a massive interest in the women that ruled, because in the ancient world, it seemed so shocking that there were women rulers.
But yet it seemed like it was more likely the further back you went. Like the more BC you went, I feel like but only within that kind of like
only
era.
In Egypt. And only in Egypt. Oh, Egypt was very insular. So there is a awesome author. Gosh, what is her name?
Was it Cooney?
Yes. Kara Cooney?
Kara Cooney.
So there is an awesome author. Her name is Kara Cooney. She's written a couple of books about this topic, specifically about the topic of female rulers in Egypt. And she made a point of saying that Egypt was so insular, like it was so isolated because it was kind of blocked off on every side. Because there was desert on like three of the four sides, and then there was a great sea on the other side that kind of kept it kind of on its own.
It was harder to get to and to travel to and from.
Right. And so its culture was kind of, even though there were a lot of people from a lot of different cultures there, the culture itself of Egypt was pretty unaffected by the outside world.
Yeah.
And so because of that, they really went by their own rules. And so having women rulers was less unlikely there than it would have been in Rome or Greece or any of the places surrounding Egypt at that time.
Yeah. But what's interesting too is that a lot of times the women were in power only as like placeholders until another man could take the throne.
Absolutely.
Because they were still running on this like very patriarchal system.
Yeah.
They were just kind of there to step in to support, like if they had a young son that obviously can't make the laws of the land. So the mother is going to step forward and take the place of their son until they're of age to do so, or for brothers or husbands or people that are unable to do so.
They were mostly co-regents. And even in the case of Cleopatra, who is obviously like the most famous,
she would go back and forth to being co-regent.
Well, she was always
between different people.
She was always a co-regent, but she was kind of the one who was in charge,
right?
Like it was like she was co-regent in name only. Like everyone kind of knew who was in charge there.
Right.
And that's kind of the common theme that you have with at least two of the three women that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Is that they were technically not in charge, but they were definitely in charge. Like
they're
the ones making the calls.
Yeah,
right?
They ran it for sure. But it is interesting to think about as a whole why male leaders were seen as so much more of a commodity than female leaders, even to this day. But I think talking about it within the scheme of of ancient Egypt. It's really interesting. So this Karakuni talks about how a woman can only produce one, maybe two children a year, right. Where mm-hmm. a man can produce hundreds of children without any hormonal changes, without having to go through pregnancy and any of the sensitivity during that time. So she explains, so she is there at a moment of crisis to protect the patriarchy when something goes wrong with the succession from man to man. As soon as it can go back to the patriarchal system, she is removed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it makes sense when you talk about ancient Egypt specifically was so very focused on the monarchy. They don't ever use that word, but it gets across what I'm trying to say.
It was about keeping the kingship in like its line, right? Essentially, because it couldn't go outside of its like specific bloodline,
because the divinity of the bloodline was so important.
Yeah,
more important than I think it is in almost any other monarchy.
It's so important that like we've talked about cultures in the past where incest was part of things,
right? But
this is Game of Thrones shit right here. It is like it is. So much incest to keep the bloodline pure that it is.
You are marrying brothers, uncles, children. It is really messed up.
It's not like it's cousins and second cousins. No. This is like
directly we have a parent in common.
Yeah, like real gross shit.
Yeah.
Which is also why, you know, we're going to get to it when we talk about Cleopatra, but I have to say it right off the bat because I think when you think about Cleopatra, yes. you always think of like, oh, this undeniable beauty, right?
It's unlikely
that she was gorgeous. However, she was really fucking smart, super charming. People said that her voice was really nice to listen to. Like every way that she's described is like beautifully.
Yes.
But they never describe her appearance except for in like depictions of her that have been drawn. But that kind of runs the gambit because a lot of times these female pharaohs were portrayed more manly in their busts and in their paintings and things like that to kind of keep up that same appearance of like power and strength.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's very difficult to know. And we will talk about this when we get to Cleopatra, who we're going to get to kind of last because she was the last in the line of the three that we're going to speak about today.
Right.
But it's kind of difficult when talking about Cleopatra because we don't really know what she looked like. Not that that's the most important thing, but I feel like that has been made to
be an important thing in her story. She's been made to be like she was Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
You know?
And genuinely, I get the impression from the things that I've read in the prep for this episode, which was a lot. I read so many articles, I feel like.
For this
episode. But I get the sense really that I don't think that she was a great beauty. In fact, I think that that's very much not the case. But a lot of people who point to her being very plain or very homely are pointing to like her image on coins and things like that, in which she does look more quote unquote masculine.
Well, and then that there's also different also be beauty standards,
right?
Too.
And that could also be a play, right? Like you said, where she's intentionally portraying herself as more masculine on purpose. Right. So I kind of just get the sense that she is a very average looking woman. Like there is
honestly, she's probably a little bit worse for wear than average because of the long history of incest in her family. There's chances that there was some health problems, there was some physical disfiguration and things like that from what I've read. But because I know that I was reading that there's like some other people in her family. There's someone with like a really big head.
Oh, I'm certain. I mean, I'm certain there is some of that. But she was still able to
seduce
for the other
incredibly like powerful men. Mm-hmm. She was able to also like not seduce romantically, but seduce so many people around her because she was so smart and charming. And I think that looks aside, it doesn't matter in the end because she had the way about her. I think that was very enticing to people.
She had that X factor,
which
for
is
sure.
why yeah. I think we think of her as being beautiful because we put those two things together. Like she was so charming and blah, 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 blah.
Well, and she also did use her sexuality, I think, in a way that like a lot of women weren't doing at that time.
Done. Yeah. No. Yeah. And a lot of, you know, makeup use and things like that. So I think that that's why we would kind of use those clues to create this image of her. And also in pop culture, I doubt we're talking about the amount of incest going on in these families.
No.
So we're not going to be like putting prosthetics on Elizabeth Taylor's face. You know
what
I mean?
No. I mean, also she wasn't She didn't look like Elizabeth Taylor, just in any way, in
any way.
Okay, so let's jump in. Let's start talking. I wanted to kind of start off with talking about women in ancient Egypt, just kind of in general, just to give a general overview. Because like I said, Egypt is kind of separate from the rest of the ancient world. We consider it to be a great ancient civilization, as we should, alongside, you know, the Romans and the Greeks of the time. But it was set aside because of the way that they operated. Women in ancient Egypt were ahead of their time. They could not only rule the country, but they also had many of the same basic human rights as men. And like we said, when they ruled the country, it was always in a co-regent capacity, even if it was in name only. In fact, there was no word for queen in ancient Egypt.
Right, exactly.
It was always considered a female king.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's why a lot of times archaeologists and things would be confused when they were first learning about a lot of these female rulers, because in the inscriptions they would find, they would see the word king in there and get confused.
Right, right. As a ruler. Now, I'm sure that there was a word for queen as the partner of the king. But when we're talking about like a pharaoh, there was no like...
Pharis.
Ruling queen. Right.
Pharis.
Yeah, right. So... This is not to say that the society was still not a patriarchal one, like we said. Men were more likely to hold positions of authority within the government and management roles outside of the home, while women were still more likely to manage the household and were responsible for things like cooking and sewing. While just across the sea in Rome, women were mostly expected to be silent in public and held no political or legal rights, Egyptian women could own land, choose whom they married as well as divorce, and owned businesses.
Wow.
So there's an Egyptologist named Barbara Watterson, and she wrote, quote, "In ancient Egypt, a woman enjoyed the same rights under the law as a man. What her rightful entitlement rights were depended on her social class, not her sex. All landed property descended in the female line from mother to daughter on the assumption, perhaps, that maternity is a matter of fact, while paternity a matter of opinion. A woman was entitled to administer her own property and dispose of it as she wished. She could buy, sell, be a partner in legal contracts, be executor in wills, and witness to legal documents, bring an action at court, and adopt children in her own name." An ancient Egypt.
They had all that back then?
Right, yes. Yeah, you could adopt kids.
I know, you could own property.
Going
I mean,
to court.
Jesus.
Yeah. An ancient Egyptian woman was legally competent and capable, which we don't see
today.
You don't even see that.
She's like fucking hysterical.
In Victorian England.
No.
You know? In contrast, an ancient Greek woman was supervised by a male guardian, and many Greek women who lived in Egypt during the Ptolemaic period, observing Egyptian women acting without this guardian, were encouraged to do so themselves. In short, an ancient Egyptian woman enjoyed greater social standing than many modern women of other societies, both ancient and modern. So,
which probably gave the women the, I was going to say the cojones because I can't think of any other word, but the ambition, there we go, to be able to be rulers themselves, because they didn't have that inequality in the same level as other, as different parts of the world did.
Right. They were seen as capable and competent. So, like, they weren't given necessarily the same status as men. Like, men definitely were still seen as a higher status. They were more likely to hold
much
office.
Like today. And, I mean, honestly, it reminds me a lot of, like, what we go through now. Is it more common for, you know, powerful white men to remain powerful?
Right.
Yes, of course. But there's still all different kinds of people that feel ambitious enough to go after that power still.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and the society is telling you, you are capable, you're competent. We know that you can kind of advocate for yourself.
Right.
Which does allow you more space to say, like, okay, well, if I can advocate for myself, why can't I run this country? Like, there's no reason why I couldn't. And to be honest, and listeners, let us know if you want this. We could do an entire episode just on like the everyday, ordinary roles of women in ancient societies, because like it is fascinating to see. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times people talk about Sparta and the way that women had a lot of agency in those societies as well. But it is really fascinating. But for today's episode, I just kind of wanted to give you that so that we had like a little bit of a backdrop into the world that these women were coming up in and like maybe why they felt like they had the ability to rule in their own right.
Totally. Who are we starting with?
So I think that we should probably start with Hatshepsut.
Who I call Hattie.
Hattie. We're going to call her Hattie. I know.
I had nicknames for all of them because it was just annoying to type the names each time. So we got Hattie, we got Neff, and we got Cleo.
Yes. Oh, good idea. Good idea. I did type her name out every time, and it was annoying.
Hatshepsut.
So it's Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut. But it's kind of hard to say quickly. Hatshepsut. Yeah. But she was the sixth pharaoh in the 18th dynasty. And I have to say...
And the foremost of noble ladies.
She was fascinating to me. I really expected to go into this episode kind of focusing more on the other two, because Nefertiti and Cleopatra obviously are names and images that you see in modern culture so often.
Right.
And our girl Hattie here is not one that you see all
that
often.
Don't sleep on our girl Hattie.
But she is fascinating. So when she was in her early teens, so maybe like 14 or 15, it's a little unclear, she was widowed when her husband and her brother, her half-brother, Pharaoh Thutmose II, died. According to custom, she was then made regent for her stepson, Thutmose III, because at the time, he was only like 1 or 2 years old.
And he was the son of another wife of Thutmose II.
Yes. So
it was like her stepson.
Is her stepson. Yeah. Her stepson nephew. Yes. So she
honestly
had
there's
daughter.
So much of that. There's like then her brother husband did this.
It was very confusing because I was clicking between articles and there were some articles that would describe him, Thutmose the third.
They all have the same name.
Right. And some would describe him as her son and some would describe him as her nephew. And I'm like, are these two different people? They're not.
Nope.
It is her son nephew. Thutmose the third. And yes, she had had one child. She has one child throughout her life. It is a daughter with her husband brother. The son was only about 1 or 2 years old. Very, very young. Obviously far too young to rule. So even though he was
candy
crowned.
For everybody.
Yeah. He was crowned as king at that young age. She became regent, and that was very customary. There was nothing weird about that. It was like,
no,
she
like
was
we said, you would step in for the next heir until they would be able to perform their duties.
Right. I mean, and if you were to think like, oh, well, why wasn't his mother the regent? Well, she wasn't the first wife, basically.
Yeah.
Like
there's a hierarchy here.
Yeah. Hattie was the first wife. So this would ensure, though, that she was ruling even in a regency capacity for the next 15 years or so, because they weren't going to hand over the nation to Thutmose III until he was about 15 years old. So she was already kind of in it for a while. And she really did kind of rule, actually, because in early depictions of Thutmose III's kingship, it was clear that though still a baby, he was the pharaoh. So you can see these depictions where they've kind of got him a little baby pharaoh, but like kind of in like a grown person's body, like real depictions of him as the king. And then there are depictions of Hattie kind of standing out off to the side in this regency
role. In support
role.
Of
and then
Thutmose the third.
You start to see slowly, like around the seventh year of her regency, the depictions change.
And she starts having her name and pictures more prominent than that of her nephew son.
Right. Yes. And she's also in clothing that would suggest that she is the pharaoh. Like they wouldn't give her that flail and crook, which is the things that they hold. You know, you often see it like across their chest.
Yeah.
She's holding that. She's bare chested. She's got the pharaonic false beard, that like fake kind of
beard. Yeah, they would often paint her with muscles and a beard, and all of that is the traditional male garb of a pharaoh.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that I kind of love about her is how misunderstood she is, because when they finally discovered her, and there were reasons why, and we'll get to it, why she wasn't discovered for a minute. But when they discovered her in the 1930s, whenever Egyptology was all the rage and all of these like Europeans were going to Egypt and kind of like discovering things, when they initially discovered her, they believed that her taking over was this very like vain, ambitious, self-serving act, that she was this like unscrupulous woman who like went in and took over.
Right.
But more recent scholarship actually suggests that it was a political crisis or a threat to the throne or another branch of the royal family that made her feel obligated to take over fully as pharaoh. She was
was more important than anything else. They couldn't have somebody else. They couldn't have a weak link for someone to come in and take over because there was a baby in charge, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So she needed to declare herself king in order to protect not only her stepson, but also the entire like kingdom. Like that's kind of how she thought of it.
The entire bloodline. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was actually incredibly smart too. As pharaoh, Hatti reestablished the trade networks that had been halted during the Hyksos occupation of Egypt, which led to building the wealth of the 18th dynasty. She oversaw preparations and funding for a mission to the land of Punt, which was a major trading hub. The trading expedition occurred during the ninth year of her reign, and they set out in her name with five ships accommodating 210 men. Goods such as frankincense and myrrh were then transferred to Egypt, getting ready for Jesus' birthday.
That's right.
With this, they planted 13 live myrrh trees, which is the first recorded attempt to transplant foreign trees.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
It is very cool. So the frankincense that they got from Punt, they would grind down, and that became coal eyeliner, and it's its first recorded use. So all of that very infamous imagery of Egyptians with this elaborate eye makeup, this elaborate cat eye eyeliner, comes from her reign.
Have you ever used coal as eyeliner? Just like real coal?
You know, I feel like I did for like something educational whenever I was in like middle school. Like I feel like they maybe did it in school or something like that.
I did a production of a one-man show when I was in college, and I had to like burn and kind of singe and hit with charcoal my costume for it. Mm-hmm. And so I had extra bits of charcoal, and my mom would tell me that she would like dip a little like eyeliner pencil or thing in water and use that. And I'm like, I'm going to do this for the show. And then I took the rest and kind of smudged it on my eyes to make it kind of a smoky look. But it was great eyeliner. I was like, this is really good.
Yeah. And I just love, of course, it was a woman king who was like, you know, we can make makeup, right?
Yeah.
Like
we can look good doing this.
We can be real hot. And for years and years, everybody's going to look back on us and they're going to be like, the ancient Egyptians were so hot. Because like, let's be real, part of the appeal. Like when you watch The Mummy, or when you watch even animated, they did not need to make all of those animated people so hot.
They were all gorgeous. I mean, they've always given Jesus a 12 pack. They didn't need to make Jesus like that.
Moses in Prince of Egypt.
Moses,
sexy.
Mother, may I?
Ramses, hot. You've got the voice of Ralph Fiennes and he looks like that.
Mm.
Come on. Okay. Anyway, so you might be thinking, you know, she ruled for like 20 years, a little over 20 years, almost 22 years.
Which is a lot for the fact that her stepson, wasn't it supposed to be that when he was like 15
exactly.
or whatever?
Exactly. He was definitely of age to take over. And so you might be wondering, like, why didn't he take over?
Yeah.
And there was an Egyptologist in this Smithsonian article that I read that kind of talked about it. And it seems like actually their relationship was fine. Like, it's not like he was under house arrest or anything. He was basically out, which, because you read all of those like Tudor, like when you're studying.
He was a locked in the tower.
Exactly. When you're studying like English history, that stuff happens all the time. Yeah. They like lock them up or something. But that's not what she did. They seem to have an okay relationship. So he was off learning how to be pretty much like a good little soldier, basically. And this Egyptologist, or actually she's not an Egyptologist. Her name is Catherine Rohrig, and she is the curator of Egyptian art at the Met in New York City.
Uh-huh.
But she said that even if she wanted to step down, she couldn't at that point because she was officially the pharaoh. She had come forward as like this high priestess and had been endorsed. And a lot of people were like, okay, well, the gods want you in power at this point.
Yeah, I've heard that also she did a lot to kind of like help her own image because there was some controversy with her rising to power in the beginning. So there was a lot about her proving her own like royal lineage and improving her image. And then another thing that I'll talk about in a little bit that I think probably made her more popular amongst her people as well.
Yeah. So they basically said that once you took the attributes of kingship, that was it. You were a god. So it's not like it was something that you could just retire from. You were king for the rest of your life. So by the time she had been elevated to that point, it wasn't as if she could just pass it along to her son.
Right. You know, she would have to then die, right, for him to take over.
That's my understanding. Yeah. Now, I mean, I could be wrong because there are...
I didn't look up who took over after she died, so...
It is Thutmose the Third.
Little Thutty the...
Thutty the Third.
33.
Her son nephew takes over after her. But I mean, I have seen it done previously where they did do a lot of this co-regency. So for instance, like when we get to Cleopatra, her father wasn't dead when she became co-regent. Like she was co-regent already. So I'm imagining that if it ever got to the point where she was incapable of ruling just because she was too old, or maybe even that she just wasn't interested in it anymore, then at that point she could probably allow him to take over all the practical day-to-day tasks of ruling. That's just what I would assume that she would be able to do, but it never got to that with their relationship. And so because of that, they were co-regents, but he was so much more invested in kind of like learning the art of war and preparing for becoming king in the future. And she did all of the practical day in, day out ruling of the actual kingdom.
Right.
Yeah.
She was also one of the most prolific builders in ancient Egypt, commissioning hundreds of construction projects. Some say her buildings were grander and more numerous than her Middle Kingdom predecessors. During her reign, so much statuary was produced that almost every major museum with ancient Egyptian artifacts in the world will have Hatti's statuary among their collections. She had several large renovations done to restore what was previously destroyed and was known to go for the bigger and grander designs. She had designed twin obelisks, which at the time were the tallest in the world, erected at the entrance of the temple. One still survives as the tallest surviving ancient obelisk on earth. Its twin broke in two and toppled. Another project was the Chapelle Rouge, which was intended as a shrine to Hatti's life and may have been placed between these two obelisks as well. She also had a mortuary temple built called Temple of Deir al-Bahri. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing it. It is located in what is now called Valley of the Kings at a site on the west bank of the Nile River where many pharaohs after her would choose to rest. So that was actually like a really big legacy that she was leaving behind, is this like very grand piece where all of the future pharaohs and kings would be buried.
Right. She actually had her father moved to that same area. And I think it was actually considered one of the wonders of the ancient world at the time when it was built.
Yeah, these obelisks, the way they describe them, and I think I'm saying that word right. I apologize
you are.
If I'm saying it wrong.
Yeah.
It sounds incredibly like major and grand and like super. To me, it almost sounds like the ancient Egypt version of the Twin Towers.
Yeah, I mean, and the way that they talk about her constructions and the things that she built, I realize that there might be a lot of sexism in the way that they speak about her, but they describe her architecture and her designs as being more feminine in nature. Like, they're softer, and it's at a huge contrast to what was being built at the time, and that's why they were so kind of, like, revolutionary.
Yeah.
Another thing about her is that Hatshepsut, she left Egypt better than she found it. She carried out her public works program across the empire, and it mostly concentrated on an area around Thebes, and she was able to build a network of roadways and sanctuaries. And so she really improved a lot of the infrastructure for like average everyday people in Egypt as well.
Importing and exporting with the, Puntland, whatever mm-hmm. it was called, was such a huge
trade,
thing for trade that it made everything more profitable.
Yeah, absolutely. So she ended up dying in her 22nd regional year, which is a long time. And for the time,
she was in her like mid-40s,
I guess. Considered very much middle age, like at the time that she passed away. So there's no contemporary mention of her cause of death that has survived until now. After her death, her son-nephew, Thutmose III, attempted to obliterate her name and memory from history by destroying...
I'm like, what the fuck? Because I guess he was even like a really ambitious builder, like his stepmother and all of that. And he's like, but... I'm going to get rid of any evidence that you were ever the ruler.
Right. I mean, initially, I think people thought that this was very vindictive and it had to have been like based on hate or like he really disliked her or something like that.
Or pride.
But a lot of modern Egyptologists now believe that it wasn't any personal malice that he had towards her. It was more about her unconventional reign and the fact that she, or the fact that he felt like she set a dangerous precedent moving forward. He didn't start having her be wiped from the record until late in his reign. It's not like it's something that he did immediately.
Okay.
Like he went in and started getting rid of every like bit of evidence of her.
Why did he think it was harmful if she did all of these wonderful things just because she was a woman?
I think that that's what it is. So there was a Egyptologist in the Smithsonian article who... That's basically what he said. He said it was to prevent the possibility of another powerful female ever inserting herself into a long line of Egyptian male kings. Mm. Like it somehow undermined the importance of having a male pharaoh.
Totally.
And so...
But I mean, like because of this, we didn't even know anything about her for a really long time. Scholars knew little to nothing about her until 1822 when they were able to decode and read the hieroglyphics on the walls of the Deir el-Bahari.
Yeah, I mean, and even then, like I said, like in the 20s and 30s when Egyptology was really like ramping up and they were learning a lot about what happened at the time, a lot of the literature that was written about her early on was incredibly chauvinistic.
Yeah.
It depicted her as this like, power-hungry woman who depicted herself as a man when that's very much not... the case. I mean,
no,
it
was more for like survival and status quo. And also I feel like a sign of respect for her to be put in that beard and things like that, because that's the way that they respected their pharaohs at the time.
Right. But she was never like, I want to go out of my way to say that she never hid the fact that she was a woman. Like she depicted herself in this very traditional way as a pharaoh with this like beard and in a very muscular way. And
because
she's a
pharaoh, and that's how you display that.
Right. But the inscriptions on her statues, they always contain some indication of her gender. There would be a title such as Daughter of Re or feminine word endings. And it would sometimes result because combining these feminine word endings with traditional like pharaoh titles would often result in things like His Majesty herself. Right. So she always would like put these things in that are like, I'm being true to who I am while also respecting the tradition of
the male leader and things like that.
Yes.
But she's just stepping in the plate like, I am the man now.
Yes. Yes. I'm the captain now. So in 2007, Egyptian archaeologist Zahi Hawass identified a previously excavated royal mummy as Hatshepsut. And Catherine Rowing, who I mentioned earlier, is among the scholars awaiting more evidence to bolster whether or not this is actually her.
Right. The mummy is in a museum in Cairo right now, but they are still looking to positively identify.
And the reason why they think it might be her is because they found her in the Valley of the Kings.
Yeah.
Which would stand to reason that it's maybe, possibly, probably a female king. So we will see. The evidence is not conclusive as of yet. But I think she's
continued.
So cool. Like,
she's
honestly,
so cool.
Might be my favorite of these three.
Yeah.
I just think that she's so fun. So.
I can't pick. I don't know. I feel like maybe after we've discussed all three of them, I can tell you which one's my favorite.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
All right, well, let's hop to the next one. This one lived in my memory or in my brain, takes up lots of my brain space, and that is Nefertiti, because her bust, I remember
not
seeing,
her boobs.
Not her boobs. The bust of Nefertiti, infamous, probably one of the most like infamous ancient Egyptian images.
Statues, ever.
That you might see. She is so beautiful. Like, there's just like something really almost modern in her.
Yeah.
In that bust of her that I just can't get over. Like, I just think it's so gorgeous.
Well, and what's crazy is that she really is one of the most like famous icons of ancient Egypt, except for, you know, Cleopatra and things like that. But who she was relatively and still is relatively unknown in a lot of ways. There's a lot of question marks and speculation and theories and things like that, which is, of course, things that we love. But it's harder to give you like clear facts on everything, because there's like alternative stories to just fact about her.
You kind of have to pick a lane, because there are people who believe a lot of different things. So whenever I was doing the prep for this episode, I went with what I saw reported most often. So almost nothing is known about Nefertiti's life prior to her marriage to Akhenaten. But some Egyptologists, a lot of them, you know, believe that she grew up in the royal palace at Thebes and was probably the daughter of the vizier to Amenhotep III. So her father was probably a man named Ay.
Yeah, they go back and forth with who her parentage is. But this is also the one that I saw for the most part.
Yes, and so she was engaged then to his son Amenhotep. So I don't know exactly what a vizier does, but they must be pretty high ranking if a pharaoh is going to be like, sure, your daughter can marry my son. And it should also be said that, unlike Cleopatra, who I feel like a lot of speculation or a lot of gossip and all of these things, this lore has been kind of woven into her story. Nefertiti was a great beauty even at the time.
Her name actually means in English, the beautiful woman has come.
Yeah, I mean, she was considered beautiful.
She was a babe.
Even at the time. I also read that she was 4'6", and that was the average height for a woman.
What?
And I was like, whoa.
Wow. So Nefertiti, just like with Hattie, she was Akhenaten's first wife, or I don't know if she was the first. I have favorite. I just read first, but I have written favorite. But I think she was also his first wife, which is why she ascended to rule with
him. The primary wife.
Yes.
Regardless of, I don't know how that works as far as like marriage order. I always assume that the first wife is the primary wife, but she was
I wrote favorite. I must have read that in some article.
She was the primary wife.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were really known as being this couple that changed the religion of ancient Egypt for a time while they were ruling. It was this major culture shift.
I always thought that this story was so fascinating because
it is.
The gods of ancient Egypt, like I said earlier, like that's part of what makes studying them so like interesting.
And they came in and like changed it.
Right. So they had in ancient Egypt, a lot of the reading I was doing was talking about how there were different cults to each god. And a cult didn't mean the same thing that it means right now. Right. It was more just like everyone had a favorite
different,
god.
It was different followers for different gods.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, you all are the cult of your angry neighborhood feminist. Welcome.
Hi. But yes, so early on, she was very much an adherent to the cult of Aten, which is the sun deity from an early age. And so it's said that whenever she got with
Akhenaten. My friend, so when I was in Hair, we all had to, if you didn't have a name in the show, if you were in the ensemble, you had to pick a name. And my friend was Akhenaten. And I thought it was Akhenaten. The entire time. Until I did research for this episode, it's Akhenaten.
Yes.
Goddamn.
So at the time when she married him, he was Amenhotep the fourth. And after the death of Amenhotep the third, she became queen of Egypt. And it is at this stage that some scholars claim that she exerted her influence on Amenhotep the fourth to abandon the ancient religion of Egypt and initiate his religious reforms. And they established the monotheistic religion centered on Aten. It is at this time that he changed his name to Akhenaten.
Yeah.
Yes. Wow.
All of that. So with this change of religion, Akhenaten departed from traditional images of early pharaohs and instead was depicted with hips resembling a female figure and exaggerated features, which I found really interesting. Like even Akhenaten himself was portrayed much mm-hmm. more delicately.
You can see it if you compare the sculpture at the time of like his sculpture to previous pharaohs.
Yeah.
There is a difference in the style. There's a stylistic difference.
Yeah,
there.
Their stature is perceived as being very different. Neph is featured next to her husband in many pieces of art dedicated to them, with her often shown in positions of power and authority above her husband even, with her leading the worship of Aten or driving a chariot or smiting an enemy.
Right, and there's a lot of speculation as to how devout they actually were, like if they were real proponents of this god and this religion.
Right, because they also moved the capital city and things like this, so it could have maybe been like a politically motivated move.
Yes, because they felt like there was a lot of power. The priests of the god of Amun had a lot of power because he was so extremely popular, and he is actually the god that was the most popular during Hatshepsut's reign.
It was, Amun or something like that, right? Yeah, Amun. Okay, yeah.
And she was considered basically like his daughter. Like Hatshepsut was like, that was part of how they got the people to listen to her, is there was an oracle of Amun who was like, I think I'm pronouncing that right, but there was an oracle of his that was like, she's meant to rule, Hatti is meant to rule, she is his daughter. There was too much influence of his followers. And I think that was making the ruling class kind of nervous.
Right.
And so I'm not sure how much of this kind of switching it up and going to this monotheistic religion for Aten was because they truly, truly were devout believers in it, or because they wanted
to perpetuate their power further. Yeah.
Yeah. To pull away from this other thing that was happening.
I found it interesting that Nefertiti would give birth to six daughters, and Akhenaten started taking other wives as well. And Akhenaten married his own sister, with
of
whom
course.
He fathered the future King Tut, wouldn't
yes.
you know?
Yeah. I mean, and King Tut, I watched a really interesting thing on, I think, History Channel.
Uh-huh.
Where King Tut had so many health issues.
Like, I bet he did.
And they think that contributed to his early death. Because he died at like 14. He was
yeah.
like a boy king.
Yeah.
And they think that a lot of those issues were because he was so inbred.
Yeah.
Yeah. His parents were siblings.
Yeah.
It's a real problem.
It's a real big problem.
So images which have survived depict Nefertiti officiating at religious services, receiving foreign dignitaries, moderating diplomatic meetings, and even in the traditional royal role of the king, smiting the enemies of Egypt. She is depicted in many archaeological sites as equal in stature to the king, and none of these images would have been created if there was not at least some truth behind these stories. So she must have wielded more power than any woman in Egypt, like, up to this point.
Well, and I think she was also, like, very hated after the fact, too, because after their rule was over, Egypt went back to more of their, like, traditional religious views and kind of started bad-mouthing Akhenaten and Nefertiti. His monuments were dismantled and hidden, and his statues were destroyed. His name was even excluded from the list of rulers compiled by later pharaohs. They were like, let's pretend...
Nefertiti's were?
No, Akhenaten's were.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes.
So he... And I think that that's part... Because they were a team in a lot of ways. He's described as the enemy or the criminal in archival records. And so I wonder if part of this, because they were seen as this, like, power couple that, like... changed everything, and then they were like, fuck that, we're changing it back, if there was like a lack of want to like give that same amount of respect to her because of that as well.
I think a lot of people had a big problem with them changing the way that things were done. Well, I think it was just like, you came in, you destroyed, you know, how many hundreds of years of tradition in a place that we've already established is very traditional.
Yeah.
You know, that they've always kind of stuck to the status quo as far as like how things go. And you have this pharaoh and his wife who come in and totally disrupt the way that things have been operating. And I think that there was a lot of resentment for that and a lot of resistance. I mean, you've got all these people who are holding these high like political positions who have been undermined because you've come in and said, we don't believe in all these other gods anymore. So if you are a high priest to any of these other gods, your position has now been completely undermined. And I think that was like
that's
a real
issue.
That's
not going to make them popular, you
know?
Yeah,
yeah, it was definitely an issue. So Nefertiti disappears from the historical record around the 12th year of Akhenaten's 17-year reign.
And they do believe that she... lived longer than her husband did.
Yeah, so there's a ton of speculation about what happened here. So she's officially off of the record, and it does happen almost immediately following the death of their daughter. So their daughter died in childbirth at 13.
Oh, she is a child.
Yeah, so she was 13 and she died in childbirth, and that's kind of one of the last depictions of Nefertiti is her and Akhenaten weeping. There's a like a mural or some depiction of them weeping over their daughter's body. And then following that, you really don't see anything about Nefertiti in the historical record after that point. But there are many scholars that believe that she became her husband's official co-regent under a different name, Nefer-Nefuraten, at that time. And then Akhenaten was followed as a pharaoh by, and I'm going to get this wrong, I'm not going to be able to say this right, Smenkare. We'll go with that.
Sure. Smenky.
Yes. Oh, Smenky, who some historians suggest may have been another name for Nefertiti.
Yeah. So they're saying that she continued to rule even after her husband's death.
Under a different name.
Yeah. Yes. Which, and I mean, I wouldn't put it past her.
I wouldn't put it past her either. And there is some evidence to suggest this, although, you know, of course, it's all just speculation. But even before she was erased from the official record, she was already kind of in the same way that Hatshepsut was doing. She was kind of already portraying herself in a more masculine fashion.
Right.
So I think that they kind of saw that as preparation for her to basically make an entirely new identity shift.
Right.
And the leaning proponent for this theory, which is Zari Hawass, who I've mentioned before, he wrote, the king, Smenkare, I'm not saying that right, is known as the male in the company of Meridian as his queen. However, his throne name was virtually identical to that of Akhenaten's co-regent. So there's a lot of like parallels that are happening.
Wouldn't
there.
Surprise
that,
me.
That might make you think that like there's only very subtle changes between the depictions of Nefertiti and
Smenky.
And good old Smenky.
Good old Smenky.
People think that maybe that's what happened there.
Yeah. And there's also been a lot of interesting developments when it comes to discovering her body, her mummy, and things like that. There were two female mummies that were found in the royal tomb that could be Nefertiti, and there's one where they did DNA analysis on it because they were showing that she had her left arm bent over her chest in the queenly pose. But DNA analysis couldn't get enough data to be sure, but confirmed that the person was a member of the 18th dynasty royal line. So it looks like it very well could have been the body of Nefertiti.
Yeah. So this one is kind of a bit of a mystery, but, and we can't go into it here because we don't have enough time. But if you are interested in this story, I know that history.com and I think also Nat Geo put out very interesting episodes talking about Akhenaten and Nefertiti. I highly suggest you go look at those because I find this so fascinating. Like, there are always reformers, there are always people of every generation, even going back this far, who truly do feel like they can come in and they can make a change and they can be radicals in this way. And I really feel like that's who these people were. Like, they were like, we're going to make a radical change, right? And in some ways, it may have blown up in their face, but...
But they did it.
But they did it, and I think that's so cool.
Fracking did it.
And also, just gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
She's so beautiful.
Just gorgeous. All right. Well, let's talk about someone who we didn't know if she was gorgeous or not. Let's talk about Cleopatra.
Let's talk about the biggie.
The big
because
biggie.
I feel like Cleopatra has a feminist footprint.
Yes.
On modern society. And let's be real, she may have been a psychopath.
Like, for real.
She very much may have been a psychopath. Like, she is a very scary lady. However, she represented something that I think there's a reason why we still look at Cleopatra.
We must revere her, I feel like. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, also just like there's something about a woman who does not give a fuck. And like, yes, she's terrifying because she's ruthless.
Yeah.
But it's almost that ruthlessness that makes people admire her today because it's so counter to our traditional ideas of femininity.
Especially for what we would think of as a woman during this time, you know?
Yeah.
Even though we know now that, you know, women during this time in ancient Egypt were, you know, much more like us than I think we would have thought before. But I think to a lot of us, hearing someone who was as powerful as she was, it is very like aspirational. You know?
I mean, even now, like, yes, you have to separate all of the murder and the incest and the other things about her life that were so like, ooh.
I mean, let's just talk about, so is it Ptolemy's or is the P silent?
I think it's Ptolemy. Yeah.
Ptolemy's.
Yeah. They were rough.
Let's talk about these fucking Ptolemies,
whoa,
right? So they consider themselves to be descendants of Alex the Great.
Alex the Great, our good friend Alex.
Of Alexander the Great, the Macedonian king who conquered the known world. So Cleopatra was not Egyptian. She was Macedonian. Ptolemy was his general and some say his half-brother. After Alex died and his empire was broken up, Egypt fell into the hands of Ptolemy and the dynasty was thus born. For the Ptolemies, all male descendants were called Ptolemy, while most female descendants were called Cleopatra, but not all. The Ptolemies,
but a lot of them.
But
Jesus,
a lot of them. It's
like
very
so
confusing.
Many.
It was how confusing. I was like, okay, which one are we talking about?
I know. I really had to look it up because
then sometimes they talk about Cleopatra II, and I'm like, wait, no, we're talking about Cleopatra.
Right, because
VIII.
Nowadays we think about Cleopatra as Cleopatra, but really we're talking about Cleopatra the Seventh. Like
yeah,
that's what we're going to refer to as our Cleopatra. It's
yeah.
Cleopatra the Seventh. Anything else is a different person. But yeah, I mean, like there's Cleopatra the Second, Cleopatra the Third. And they all did some messed up stuff.
Yeah. So between the 4th and 14th monarchs, things got a little nasty between the Ptolemies. They lived in such a way that where they killed as many of their close relatives as they possibly could.
Gotta do it.
Usually in a very painful and public way.
Gotta get them out of the way.
All in the name of power.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you have to do it because to me it really feels
But you have to.
It really feels like a combination of the Roys from Succession.
Yes.
If they had the same kind of like murderous instincts as like Tony Soprano. Do you know what I mean?
100%.
Because like, when you watch Succession, like they're not gonna kill each other,
but they want to.
You know that if it had been like acceptable for them to kill each other, they would be killing each other. Yeah. And like, that's what's happening here. Like, they know that they can and they're going to in order to get each other out of the way.
Yeah.
There is no sibling loyalty or love with any of the Ptolemies.
No, they have no familial, what's the word I'm looking for? Kinship whatsoever. There's no rallying around your family.
Even when you're married to them.
Even when you're married to them, you better sleep with one eye goddamn open. You never know.
If I was married to Cleopatra, I would never sleep. I would never sleep.
Like, I mean, in either way.
That woman's terrifying.
It's funny because that Kara Cooney in one of the History.com articles I was reading described the life of the Ptolemies as being very PTSD inducing.
Wouldn't it be?
I feel that.
In fact, you want to kill all your siblings because you're like, at least I don't have to worry about them killing me. I'll never have a good night's sleep if I know they're still alive.
Yeah, like one of them is going to put rat poison in my cereal in the morning. Yes. I don't know.
So some of these stories I thought were so interesting. I think we read the same article, the History.com article with Kara Cooney talking about this. And she talks about how, just to set the scene for what our Cleopatra was born into, Cleopatra II, so an ancestor of our Cleopatra, she married her brother, of course. Then she got pissed at him during an argument and had him killed. And then she married another brother. And then her daughter, Cleopatra III, overthrew her, Cleopatra II, and took up with her uncle, Cleopatra II's brother.
Who is another brother that she was married to or wasn't married to?
I think it's one that she was not married to.
There's trace brothers. Okay.
So far, yes. And so after she married her uncle, her mother's brother, she kicked her mother out into exile. And then the uncle sent Cleopatra II, his sister, a package containing her son, his nephew, cut up into little bits as a birthday present.
Yep.
It's like, happy birthday, sis. Here's your baby. I cut him up. No big deal. Because then later they ended up getting, like, they resolved their issues for political reasons.
They were like, let's just put this behind us, I guess, for our family.
We can get together for Thanksgiving. It's fine.
Like, Thanksgiving in ancient Egypt. Let's do it.
It's so, like,
it is
what?
Wild. It's Game of Thrones shit. Like, you can't write it.
The things, if I had a sister, I would not forgive her for. And yet you murdered her child. And yeah, it's absolutely insane.
It's
so
crazy.
That's just a fun fact, side note, but I feel like it really does set the scene
to how Cleopatra becomes who she is.
Yeah, she learned a lot, I feel like, from her ancestors.
She's got that, like, that familial trauma going on, you know? She knows.
It's
evolution,
yes,
is taking course within her.
You've got generational trauma happening, and then also just like a good business sense, a lot of charisma,
and like, a ton of fucking smarts. Like,
yes,
she was really well educated. She could speak a bunch of languages, including Egyptian, Ethiopian, Troglodyte, Hebrew, Arabic, Syrian, Median.
I think she's a genius.
Parthian,
I really do.
And Latin.
Yeah, she was so, so smart.
And she was able to read and write in three of those languages too.
Incredible.
Which is crazy. She was taught by a tutor named Philostratos, from whom she learned a lot about the Greek arts and philosophy. She studied at the Library of Alexandria, and she would write medical texts and stuff, which would inspire some of her father's physicians on the royal court. So she actually had like this very like medical mind as well, which is something I didn't know about her at all.
Yes, I mean, and even with Cleopatra, I think people oftentimes think about Cleopatra as though she ruled in her own right, which is not really the case. Like we said earlier,
she assisted her father
and then her brothers, and then was co-regent to her infant son,
right?
Which she put in place, obviously, very deliberately so that she could rule on her own, basically.
Yeah.
But so much of this, I have to think, is just like, man, clearly Cleopatra was the right person for the job.
She was. So she was perfect for the job.
You should have just let her do it rather than like making her go through all of this stuff.
You know what? Hillary was also right for the job, and we got stuck with Trump. Yikes.
Yikes. So after she married her brother, Ptolemy the 13th.
It is the 13th. Yes. I wrote it in parentheticals
just to be sure. I wrote it in Roman numerals, so I had to take a second.
Oh, man. That's one of my educational blockers is Roman numerals. It takes me like a minute to like remember it all. So I have to write in parentheses, I always
write
the number.
I hear you. I hear you. So after she married her brother, she was 18, he was 10, which again, like, just let her rule. Like, gross. She's 18, just let her do it. Like, you don't
make her marry her fucking 10-year-old brother.
It's
gross.
It's weird. Stop it. So she initially was run out of Egypt by him when she allegedly tried to take sole possession of the throne because... Yeah.
Come on. Like, she's 18 and her husband brother is 10.
And she would just be better at the job. Obviously. Like, just let her do it.
If you want something done right,
go get it.
Do it girl your boss. Damn self.
Girl oh, boss God. Your way to the top.
Stop. If I ever hear you say girl boss again, I'm going to vomit onto this microphone. We should do an episode on that.
Yeah. So in exile, she earned the favor of Julius Caesar. Wink, wink, of Julius Caesar. And she teamed up with him and an army of mercenaries.
Because she wanted to get back at her fucking brother.
Yeah, well, she's like, I want Egypt back. Yeah. This is ridiculous. I'm in exile. I shouldn't be. I have smarts. I have charm. I'm going to use those things to get back into Egypt. And yeah. She totally did. And this is when the infamous, like, she was smuggled in to see, have a conference with Julius Caesar wrapped up in a rug.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know,
this is when all of that happened. And she... ends up defeating her brother in battle, and it ends with him drowning to death in the Nile. So one brother, one sibling, down, right? So when she gets back to Egypt, she marries her other brother, also named Ptolemy. I feel like you have to have some serious like daddy issues.
So I just started calling them by the number. So the first one I just called 13 in my notes. This one I just called 14 in my notes.
Yikes. It's not great. I don't love it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But to her credit, she doesn't have any children with her brothers, so that's good.
Yes. She did, however, did we mention that she had a baby with Caesar?
We haven't yet, no.
Okay, so although she married 14, around 47 BC, they had a son, Ptolemy Caesar. And he was known to the Egyptian people as Caesarion or Little Caesar, which is just
adorable.
All bad. I will refer to him from henceforth as Little Caesar or C-section or Caesarion section from here on out.
Yikes. But so after she marries
14,
she is believed to have had him murdered in a bid to make her son co-ruler, which again, very, very smart. So she knows that she wants to rule Egypt. She can only rule as a co-regent. She has a son. So if she kills her brother, she can make her son the regent. He's the king now of Egypt. She's the co-regent technically, but he's a baby. So yeah, she's in charge.
Little three-year-old C-section cannot rule the country.
That's right. So she also engineered the execution of her sister, Arsinoe, who was considered to be a rival to the throne. So she had already exiled her. She was like GTFO out of Egypt.
Just like what happened to her.
Right. Yeah.
But Arsinoe didn't get a army of people to fight back.
Right. And I don't know. I'm sure that there's a lot of historians who could speak on that. I don't know what all Arsinoe had going on, but not as much as Cleopatra had going on. And she struck first and had her sister executed. So she is the only remaining sibling at this point. Things are looking good.
She has full reign for the most part, except for her three-year-old son. But there was conflict in Rome against Caesar versus Mark Antony, Octavian. What did I say?
Anthony.
Oh, shut up.
Which is the singer.
That's true. Mark Antony, Octavian, and Lepidus. Both sides wanted Cleo's support, and after some stalling, she sent four Roman legions stationed in Egypt by Caesar to support the triumvirate. And this led to Mark Antony and Octavian dividing power in Rome. Mark then called upon Cleo to come to the city of Tarsus, which is south of modern Turkey, to tell her the role she played in the aftermath of Caesar's assassination. According to the story dramatized by Mr. William Shakespeare, Cleo sailed to Tarsus in an elaborate ship dressed in robes of Isis, and Antony was immediately seduced by her charms.
Okay.
Thank you.
She was like 14, I think. But all right.
He agreed to protect Egypt and Cleo's crown and promised to help her remove her younger sister, Arsinoe, which we are kind of going out of order here, but it's all kind of happening at the same time.
Yes.
So he was like, you want to get rid of your sister? I will help you.
Yeah, no prob. So I want to point out here, you know, when kind of looking at these people through a feminist perspective, Cleopatra is often depicted as a seductress, but as Kara Cooney points out in that Nat Geo article or the Smithsonian article, whichever one it was, I think it's more that she uses her reproductive abilities more like a man to create a legacy. She was smart in that way.
Yeah, like, and she knew strategically how to set up her own child in a certain way to make her powerful and then her son be the next in line.
It was actually really genius. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of people didn't do this as much as she did, where she knew that a lot of her power, unfortunately, because the patriarchy came from her ability to reproduce. And she used that to her benefit. So she had children as a matter of political strategy, birthing children with two Roman warlords, Julius Caesar and Mark Antony.
Yeah, that was creating like a freaking, I was going to say power couple, but that's not what I'm looking for.
But it's an alliance, a blood
alliance.
That's
what I'm looking for. It's a blood alliance with two other like super powerful civilizations.
Yes, yes. And then she carefully placed each child in charge of a different part of her growing empire. So even though they were children or, you know, like toddlers at the time, she kind of put them in competition with Western Roman Empire. Like, she knew what she was doing. It was very, very strategic. So Roman propaganda painted Cleopatra as a debauched temptress, this like seductress kind of character.
Very femme fatale as a way to smite her.
And she used her sex appeal as a political weapon. And we're not talking about femme fatale time period, right? Like,
no.
We're talking, this is like BC.
This is like 49 BC.
Times. We are talking ancient times. And she is a very self-possessed woman in control of her sexuality. Not a thing that happened at all at this time period. So what we love about Cleopatra and why I think we hold her or hold on to her as a feminist icon is because she was unapologetic about who she was and what she wanted. And yes, like there's so much stuff about Cleopatra's personality and like the things she did that are like, you know, like definitely very sketchy, but
I think you have to put it also within the context of how things operated at the time and also with the means of garnering power for a woman at this time and what that had to take to get there. And I think that though we could see her as being incredibly ruthless and cruel in so many ways, her siblings were trying to kill her as much as she was trying to kill them. And this was, it seems like to me, the way of life then. Like, it wasn't like she was particularly terrible. It just seems like in our eyes, looking back on it now, we can see where she probably wouldn't be someone I'd want to get drinks with.
Right. I mean, like, there were so many roadblockers put up to prevent her from succeeding or to prevent her from being powerful. And she really disregarded every single one of those roadblocks.
I think she was just fucking smart. She probably wasn't here to take any of your shit. She wasn't going to be someone that you could walk all over. And that probably rubbed a lot of people the wrong
way. I think she was also just very, like, she saw things in a very black and white way is kind of how I interpret it. Where, like, she saw that, like, people were going to say, she knew that her sexuality was a weapon that she could use in order to gain power. She also knew that society would look down on her or judge her for doing that. And she said, well, that doesn't matter to
me, because I'll have my power anyway. Fuck you.
Right. Exactly. Whereas for so many of us, I mean, women especially are raised so often to be like people pleasers and to make sure that...
Oh, especially to revere to men too.
Right, yes.
To make sure that we are there supporting
and we're
them
adhering,
so that they can succeed rather than taking it on ourselves.
Yeah, and we're adhering to all of these like social structures that have been put in place, and it's very much drilled into us how important it is to do that.
Yeah.
And Cleopatra said, I don't care. And I think that that is why she remains as like this huge feminist icon for all of us.
And there's so much lore to her story as well. Like, there's all these questions around her death.
Yes.
I mean, many believe, you know, it was after Mark Antony's death. She like locked herself away and was like weeping with her female servants and poisoned herself with a snake.
Right. I mean, and we don't know that that's how she went.
Yeah.
We do know that also, and I want to just say this before we talk about her death, that like she also led warships. Like she did things that I feel like a lot of leaders at the time, not just female leaders, didn't necessarily do themselves.
Right.
When she was married to Mark Antony, she personally led several Egyptian warships into the fray alongside Antony's fleet, which is not something that I feel like was done super, super often necessarily back then, especially for a woman. But when it comes to her death, yes, there's a lot of speculation as to whether or not, I think that there is so much beauty in the idea that she had this very poetic ending where she got an asp or a cobra to bite her. And that's how she died. And it's so,
very poetic.
Yes. And we don't know if that's exactly how she died, but we do know, or most people agree, that she did take her own fate into her own hands. And I think that that's something too that we hold on to, as like this woman was so in control of like what happened to her
up to the very last second.
Yeah, that when she knew that like the chips were down and it was going down, that she was going to make the call how it was going to happen.
Yep.
And she did take her own life. How, we don't know precisely, but that is, most people agree that she did take her own life. So,
which adds more to the intrigue.
Yeah. I mean, I just find there's a reason why people find her so fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that we would necessarily think she's a good person, but I think that she did embolden so many people.
And I think it's also
women.
It's also a very great story to look to for any young girl who wants to achieve a level of success, whether it be politically or any sort of place of power. I think that though, obviously, murder is not the answer and marrying your brother and things like that is not the answer, I still think that there's like a great moral to like the dumbed down version of her story that speaks to a lot of young women and their ambition and their smarts and like having that self-assurance and knowing that you're worth it enough to have that power, where I feel like so many
don't
of
apologize.
Us don't. Yeah, we don't feel like we possess that power naturally, where I think a lot of boys and men are born thinking that they can already get that power if they want it.
Like there's, I think that people love, including myself, I think that there is this, people love the idea of Cleopatra because she represents this confidence that we wish we could have, right? Like this self-assuredness of like, I'm going to wrap myself in a rug and present myself to possibly the most powerful man in the world at this point. And I know that I can convince him to do what I want him to do.
Yeah.
And like that is, there's something to be said for like that kind of confidence is like, that unapologetic confidence is incredible.
And the way that she garnered her own sexuality too is something that we still strive for to this day.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing that's really inspirational for us all as well, because while she was seen in a very negative light for the way that she garnered her own sexuality, she knew that that too was part of her power.
Yeah. So I think all three of these women have something to teach us. And I think that that's so cool. I love looking at history in this way. And this might seem like kind of an odd first subject for Women's History Month.
I mean, we went way back in history.
We went way, way back. But there's a reason why these stories persist. And Cleopatra in particular persists in such a way. And then there are also our good old Hattie, who maybe like a lot of us didn't know about, but who was so incredibly instrumental to the idea or the vision that we all have in our heads of ancient Egypt today. She was so instrumental in forming that.
Yeah.
I think is really cool to know about that. It's women like, you know, these women did all these great things for this civilization that we still cannot shut up about.
Yep.
You know, that's cool.
Who run the world?
Girls.
Obviously. All right. That's all we've got for you today. Join us next week for another week of Women's History Month. I don't know what we're giving you.
We don't know either. Yeah.
Wait and find out. If you have any topics that you would like for us to discuss in the future, you can go ahead and email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or direct message us on Instagram at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. If you want to check out our merch, you can do so by clicking the link in our bio on our Instagram or going to the link in your show notes wherever you're listening. We have a Facebook business and group page. You can rate and review us on the business page and chat with the fellow listeners on the group page. Last but certainly not least, we have so many exciting things coming your way. If you would like to show us some extra love and support, please hop on over to the Apple Podcast app and leave us a 5-star review with a quick sentence about why you enjoy the show. All right, so all we got for you today. With all that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.